The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armitstead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's author is so popular that he was given a standing ovation, and I'm going to say his name very carefully because apparently even some of his friends get it wrong. It's Armistead Maupin, no relation to me. He's just finished what he says is the last of his Tales of the City series, The Days of Anna Madrigal. So book club MC John Mullen took him back to the first series of San Francisco set tales, which appeared as a daily paper column nearly 40 years ago. That was a pretty daunting task for a fiction writer, John suggested. Even Charles Dickens only had to produce his chapters once a week.
Well, I had lied to the editors of the paper and said I could do it, 800 words a day, 5 days a week, forever. Because they basically wanted me to be a columnist in the paper and not compete with the columnists who were already there. That alone was radical, the notion of fiction. There hadn't been any fiction in an American daily for 60 years or something when they did little romances and things. But I was panicked most of the time.
Did you write them daily, or did you write a batch sort of thing?
I had 6 weeks worth at the beginning.
Right. Okay. And how close to the edge did you get?
I was writing Monday on a Wednesday, and they were freaking out.
Yeah.
Because I would come into the office and start talking about my adventures the night before, because it was all women, so it was a lot of fun to tell it. And I was a procrastinator. When I was in San Francisco on book tour recently, the woman who was my copy editor showed up. And she remembered the time that the woman that was head of the department, which is called the People Department, it was the euphemism for the old women's department.
Yeah.
Because it was the 70s and they were starting to realize that was sounding really old-fashioned. And she came over to my typewriter and went, write. And I waited a moment. I decided that was the most offensive thing anyone had ever said to me. Uh-huh. And I went back very quietly to her desk and said, don't you ever say that to me again. And we laughed. It was what we had to do. I mean, what she had to do just to get it out of me because it was scary.
So two days, I would put it off to be only two days ahead.
Yeah. And finally, I just had to say, this is a newspaper. This is going to be on the bottom of somebody's birdcage next week. So don't be so precious about it.
You must also have been thinking about stuff which is going to kind of go through. I mean, strings of kind of plot or secrets or
things.
You must have also been thinking about how to sustain it.
Absolutely, because I was aware that it was you had, not to get too specific about it, but a lot of people read the column on the pot in the morning, so it couldn't last any longer than a good movement, and you had to hold them. I introduced a murder mystery thread that first year that was a disaster, and my editor at Harper very wisely said, you will be reviewed as a bad murder mystery and not a comedy of manners, so take it out.
Yeah.
I really didn't know a lot of, I mean, some of the really central moments when Mrs. Madrigal meets Edgar Halcyon, the dying conservative businessman on the park bench, I didn't know that was going to happen until the day of. I was feeling sort of sorry for Edgar.
Yeah.
So I thought, who have I got that might cheer him up? And so I had them share a focaccia bread sandwich, and then I thought, they really should end up fucking, basically. And it was making the editors nervous because they knew from the beginning that Anna was transgender. But they were told me I couldn't say anything about it for the first year. Best restriction I've ever had because I established her as a character who was thoroughly loved by the time they found out.
Yeah.
There are, people in America today who are trying to, rail against the trans community now that it's becoming less and less respectable to go after ordinary gay men and lesbians.
You know that thing Wilkie Collins said about somebody's asking a bit of advice about how to write serialized fiction.
Yeah.
And he said, make them cry, make them wait.
Cry was first. I knew that. I've always known that was the most important thing about my work, that they have to cry. I think it has to be rooted in you know, a kind of melancholy about life that allows the giddy moments to be acceptable.
You know, and I was slightly waiting for something bad to happen. Mm. The first really bad thing I remember was the guy, Vincent,
yeah,
who works at the helpline,
yeah,
hangs himself.
Yeah. He's been cutting off body parts for a while.
Yes. And even then he has what was... He died as organically as possible.
I mean, I got funny about it at the
end.
And Marianne is in the other room screaming at him because she knows that he's disfigured himself in the past. And she's yelling Desiderata through the door at him, that poem that every, or whatever it was, that everybody had hanging on their wall in the 70s. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here.
Can you also remember doing that Wilkie Collins thing of making, on a daily basis, a sort of cliffhanger? Usually, there's a kind of cliffhanger each one. I mean, a minor key cliffhanger, perhaps.
Yes. And later I learned to do that with the novels themselves. It was 40 years of being a tease, basically.
Yeah.
And they aren't perfect. I saw somebody on Facebook today after I had mentioned somewhere along the line that I had compiled the columns, that they were basically my first draft. Now the serious, you know, fans of Tales are saying, we've got to find them and publish them. And I'm like, no, you don't.
What did you do when you made it into a book then? I mean, you changed...
It was kind of an interesting, unusual circumstances. I assembled them on the living room floor of Rock Hudson's Palm Springs house. Yeah. He came into my life. I felt like in some ways he was a sort of angel over Tales because I met him a month or so before Tales started in the paper. And the night before it started, he invited me and a bunch of friends up to his suite at the Fairmont Hotel. And I had already bragged that I had this thing, Tales of the City, that was starting in the paper the next morning. And he went down to the desk clerk at the hotel and got an early edition of the paper and stood up, a little bit tipsy, which is something to behold when someone's 6'5", or however tall he was, and said, I have a dramatic reading to do. And he read the first chapter of Tales of the City. The first couple of lines of Tales of the City are Marianne's mother saying, come back from that wicked city. Yeah. We know how it is. We were watching Macmillan and Wife this week. It's crazy, you know. And then we became friends, and not, as is often repeated in the British press, lovers. There's a difference between playing around with somebody and being their lover. If you're gay, you know what that is. But it's an important distinction, because I was not alone in that either. He was a good friend. I didn't realize how good a friend. The people around him told me that I was, because in some ways you never knew. He was, you know, in such a bubble.
Yeah.
But
and then he gets into the Tales, doesn't he? So he's in bed with Michael.
Yeah, he's in bed with Michael. and Michael is not very successful.
No, commenting on his...
And he says to Michael, you know, I'm just another guy like you. I realize now how poignant that was, that the idea of someone's stardom got in the way of that, you know, some private moment of bliss always. And Michael said, as someone else I know said... Michael is thinking, no, you're not, and I'm Doris Day.
And he's in the novel as sort of a blank. I mean,
I use that Victorian convention because I wanted to make a point about the nature of the closet in Hollywood. I was uncomfortable with his closet because I was out and public, and it felt strange to me. It had not happened for a while. And then I realized this is one more thing in my life that I had to use. So I changed details that would have identified him.
Did people guess? I mean, did...
Yes. Yeah, of course they did. Yeah. I mean, and it was pretty widely known that Rock was gay. It wasn't a secret except to the great center of America. Yeah. Cities he hadn't actually personally traveled to.
I mean, there's quite a lot of autobiographical material which got
always
into
them. That was just the most identifiable one, but I use things all the time, and sometimes I joke that when people say, "Are you Michael?" I say, "No, I'm Dee Dee." because yes, I mean, there are aspects of every character that pull on my own experience. Brian is a lawyer who dropped out. I flunked out of law school. He was Randy and prowling the town, and so was I, just with different prey. And I just got bold when it came to the women and made the assumption that they were human beings like everybody else and and imagined what they'd be thinking in any given moment.
And of course, you got the thing that I noticed most when I first read it, which was you had a place, you had a city. And I sort of was rather flattered by the way that the book referred to these places as if I knew.
Yeah,
Where they are, but what they were.
And I was doing that myself. It was because it was a character in the story. I was not only picking which characters that day would be talking to each other and how would that forward the plot, I was picking a spot for it to happen in, and I picked all my favorite spots. Yeah. So
the fact that there are these locations is also pretty key to what else happens in the tales, which is fantastic coincidences all the time. It's this kind of web of characters. But I'm sort of trying to predict who is going to, because it must have been a pleasure for you.
Oh, it was a joy.
Doing that.
To make the discovery myself as it was going along. And to realize that I could, tie those things together. It's also part of what I believe, that there is this pattern in life. And our lives are beautiful or not beautiful, depending on whether or not we see it and can find it or make the effort to look for it.
One of the ones which is both cliffhanger and coincidence quite early on is John, the gynecologist. He has a passing sexual encounter with a guy, and they introduce themselves. He says, "Oh, I'd quite like to see you again." He introduces himself. And the last line of the episode is that the guy who's been nameless up to now, I'm Beecham. And then you stop and think, oh, God, so that's possible too. Yeah, he does that too.
Well, let me tell you where that came from. Yeah. I was at the baths one night, as I was wont to be in those days. I met this cute guy, very Beecham-like guy. And now don't fidget, John. I'm not going to embarrass us.
No, I'm not. I'm
You've turned stoical. The color of that
I'm
book.
I'm stoical.
But I met this guy, and the next night I worked at a show called Beach Blanket Babylon that still runs. I wrote the original dialogue for Beach Blanket Babylon, and some of the jokes may be 40 years old still, I don't know. It had just moved to a new place called the Club Olympus, which billed itself as America's first bisexual nightclub. It made no sense at all, but they were trying to argue. I mean, they were basically trying to say that everyone could get laid at this nightclub. I'm not sure anyone did. They had a discotheque downstairs at what later became Dance Your Ass Off. And I'm down there, and lo and behold, there's this guy I saw the night before, and he asked me if I wanted to dance. So we started dancing. It's not something that I normally do even then. And he said, over here. And I realized he was moving me behind a sort of column in the middle of the room. And I thought, what is going on here? And finally he said, my wife is over there. And I looked around the column, and there was this young woman who was about 7 months pregnant, and she was holding a giant, I think, Louis Vuitton or Gucci bag or something in front of her, standing there looking kind of forlorn, as you would if your husband was around the corner dancing with a man. And that's where Dee Dee and Beecham came from. I just saw the two of them. I saw this person, the woman that I was sympathetic towards, and the man that I thought was a bit of a shitheel for even wanting to flirt with the idea of dancing with me with his wife in the room.
Well, I must ask about one more thing before I give everybody else a chance, which is you sort of mentioned about doing female characters, and I'm sure everybody here would feel with me that the female characters are just as vivid as the male characters. Male-female friendships are kind of quite important in this novel, particularly gay male, non-gay female friendships.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, it's become a huge cliche.
Yeah, they got it from you, didn't they?
Yeah, you certainly did.
Yeah.
I remember because I thought, this is such rich material.
Yes.
I had those friendships, and I thought, oh, man, the conversations you can have.
So
and
why is the material so rich, do you think? that kind of...
Well, for one thing, if you're writing in a daily newspaper, you can have a non-sexual situation. That's the appeal of such friendships, too, because both sides of it are not trying to climb in the sack with the other. And so real intimacy happens, you know, things are shared. If it's a straight woman, you can both talk about men. But Michael's friends with Mona, and she's revealed, he's mostly just mad at her because she didn't tell him that she had a girlfriend once upon a time. The man-on-man action in Tales of the City is sparse at the beginning.
Yes.
I had to write one scene between John and Michael that was a bed scene, but I couldn't actually say they were in bed, so it would be something like, John adjusted the sheet. or headboard would be involved. I had to really tread very carefully.
So it is like those Rock Hudson and Doris Day films where they weren't allowed to... They're allowed to wear pajamas, but only if they were in separate apartments and phoned each other.
And their toes could touch on the screen.
That necessity becomes a virtue in a way.
It was good for me, because if I had been free, I might have had them all madly humping from the beginning and wouldn't have had anything. So it was useful. And then, of course, as it went on, some of the novels... I mean, the novels got more graphic. Being there first is a big thing to remember in life. If you've got something that nobody else has done and you can do it, chances are it'll serve you.
Well, I think... more than time when we should. I should give everybody here a chance. So if you'll be patient, we have got a travelling mic and we do sort of, I think, need to use it.
I just want to thank you for a start, just to say thank you for actually changing my life from Backstreet Birmingham, really, our second city, where homosexuality and all that kind of stuff was all very dark, especially the late 80s. And you made me feel, through your books, that actually I was a person and a normal person. And I just want to thank you for that. But the big question is, if you had to redo Tales now, in modern society now, how do you think it would actually pan out?
Well, it would be an old fart trying to write young characters. I mean, that's one of the things about ending the series. I realize it was time. I mean, you know, there's some younger characters in the current book, and I kind of know how to write them. But my responsibility to the youth of the world would have been... I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do it, I don't think. I remember reading I Capture the Castle when I was young, Dodie Smith's wonderful book that has some, I think, pretty credible teenagers in it. And then I read, years later, I read a novel she wrote in the late 60s in which she tried to write flower children. And it was kind of tragic how off the mark it was. I wouldn't have the nerve to answer your question. And I am writing tales now. I mean, I just did the last one, so this is what I would do. And it has to be from the viewpoint of what I see and know about. And in many cases, with the all the characters, all the people from 28 Barbie Lane are in their 60s. And to my horror, how dare they get older and remind me of how old I am, you know? But I wouldn't... there's one actually being attempted in the Chronicle right now, Click City. I have not read it, but it's about techies in the city.
Like Marianne Singleton, I came from Ohio to San Francisco, so it was the first books I've read, and it you do preserve it for posterity, a certain generation, a certain time in San Francisco, and possibly things that will never change in San Francisco, and I'm just very happy about that, that I have that forever. And I wondered if you want to talk about your life in Albuquerque and any future writing job projects that you have.
I live in Santa Fe.
Oh, Santa Fe, sorry.
It's a big difference.
Oh,
you don't do not want to live in Albuquerque. No, and that was a cheap joke. And Santa Fe is a much smaller place. Santa Fe is 65,000 people. And prettier, yeah. I'm gay, what can I tell you? Christopher and I live in an adobe house. I had to explain adobe the other night. I loved doing that. Uh-huh. But a simple mud house. everything in Santa Fe, as of 100 years ago, the time of Lawrence, they decreed that nothing could be higher than the cathedral and that it had to be in the Pueblo style. that takes some, you know, stretching when you're doing a Whole Foods, but it is really beautiful place. And we live on a rolling desert landscape that's pink when the rain hits it during the monsoon season. The sand turns pink. And I told Chris I wanted to name the place the Rancho Rosado, meaning, you know, the pink ranch, and he thought that was a bit much. So we live at the end of a dirt road. I got in trouble because somewhere along the line I said there's not street life like there is in San Francisco, but there really isn't. You can't join a tide of people and bump into people you know. You can bump into people you know, but it'll probably be at the dog grooming place or the, you know, somewhere where you're out doing business. I wrote a great deal of Anna Madrigal there because it's wonderfully peaceful, and we have the advantage for the first time ever of having a big enough place, and there's a casita out across the arroyo where we put up friends, and you can actually hang out with your friends in a great way. I never did that in San Francisco. We'd go to some place in public, but nobody had a place big enough to have guests. Even then, we miss it. We miss San Francisco. I felt very defensive about it when I was leaving because there were newspaper articles. How can he do this to us? and maybe because in the back of my mind I was thinking, what the hell are you doing? But we'd like to have a little place to land there, in addition to having this sweet house with some property. I was on Facebook, actually. Some realtor in San Francisco said, let me help you find a little place. And I told him how much we could spend, and we needed it to be dog-friendly and have a parking space. And he wrote back, you may have to put out for that. It's very, very expensive there. It's like the center of London, you know. People find the pretty places and buy them up.
I think I can claim to be one of what I might call your married men converts.
Okay, you've got a lot to answer for. That can mean anything in my universe.
I was a married man, and I only came out in when I got to 40.
You can still be married, you know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We talked about it. We melted over.
Did I help? Did it help? Is that what you're?
Yeah, this is one of the point I'm coming to because basically I would describe the Tales of the City books were a set of books that occupied bookshelves in all manner of households, straight households, mixed households, gay households.
Yeah.
And you went into a house and you saw that set in the corner of the bookcase and you kind of knew that you were on amongst friends. I mean, I thank you enormously for that.
Thank you very
Moving
much.
On
we were all brought
that.
Up that way, by the way. I mean, that's why it was such a relief to be able to tell the story, to, you know. And I was lucky because I had a city that embraced me where the straight people were far less worried about my homosexuality than I was. The first straight lady I came out to came over and looked at me and said, big fucking deal. And it was a revelation, you know?
If I can just throw in a technical question.
Yeah.
Which is how did you make the transition from meeting the Daily Deadline to then when you're actually looking at setting out a novel? Did you move from improvisation to setting out a timeline and the likes of that?
That's a good, really good question.
Yes, it is a good question.
It started after I had sold the first two, and I realized they were going to be novels now. I think by the time you get to, maybe it's more like Significant Others is the first time, or Baby Cakes, where I realized that a daily episode could be part of a larger chapter, and so I would envision what the chapter would be and then write 5 days worth of daily episodes that would then be sewn together when I was done. And then by the time I, Sure of You was not serialized anywhere, the sixth novel, that's when I started to slow down and polish, and I had that luxury and I took it. Maybe that's the answer to why I've stopped. I don't think I can move any slower.
A lot of homosexuals have to go through various coming out processes, you know, coming out to yourself, to your friends, to your colleagues, to your family, etc. In your opinion, what do you think is one of the final coming out stages that you can...
I'll let you know when it happens. You always have to do it. You always, somebody driving me to the back to my ranch saying, oh, it looks like the wife is waiting for you. And I said, well, not exactly. There is the assumption of heterosexuality is always made. We face those challenges every time we're with a stranger and we hear that little voice saying, well, just don't bring that up, or this is going to take too much trouble. I just think it's our job to be joyful and honest at every moment. And that's why things have gotten so much better, because so many people have, and our families have seen who we are and are now supporting us. We're feeling that in the culture at large, more and more people just think that, it's nonsense, the cruelty that's extended towards gay people. And I think we have to... I want to figure out a way to help out in the rest of the world in places where it's really heartbreakingly terrifying. It's so easy just to click on the thing about what's happening to kids in Nigeria, for instance, and then look away because it's just too horrible to think about, or the execution of gay people in the Middle East and Sochi. I'm still kind of pissed about that. I mean, it helps that I'm not a huge sports fan, so I can't say that I'm boycotting anything. But there should have been more leadership on a big level expressing, a lot has happened. I think Putin has gotten the message. I guess that's one of the reasons I find that really annoying, because, if you're going to persecute us, put your fucking shirt back on. Because you're looking awfully queer to a lot of us.
Hello. I was really interested to hear you talking about being under pressure to write 800 words a day. And then as your novels, as they went on, you could take a slower pace. But do you have any particular rituals that you adopt when you write? Or can you really write anywhere at all?
Usually early in the morning, or earlier, not early, but when I get out of bed, when I'm fresh. When I'm working, I do have a peculiar habit that I've had since I was a child, and that was putting myself to sleep with a story. I actually had 3 serials running in my head when I was 8 years old. I guess you could call them that. They were just stories that I picked up where I'd left the night before. So when I've got material, that's looking thorny to me, which is every day, I go to bed thinking about it. With the theory that when you drift into sleep, that you can wander more than when you're being disciplined and writing, and that it might act, I don't know whether it works or not, but I do that. But beyond that, no, I don't have a thing about. I did a ritual this year when certainly a ritual when I was done with the last book. We planted a tree in the garden that we named Anna's Tree. That felt, or rather, we had someone plant the tree. And I posed with them. Occasionally, there's a joint involved. If I hit a place where I'm just boring the hell out of myself, I remind myself that play is central to keeping the story fun, and sometimes I don't do it while I'm writing. If I'm stoned, I can't even make my fingers hit the keys.
As a straight female, I really love Tales of the City, and I was just wondering, Anna, did you set out to make her eccentric and bohemian? and welcoming lodgers with a joint? Or is it based on someone you know?
God knows she didn't give me joints, but my grandmother, who was English and a suffragist in 1914, all over Britain, she traveled around making speeches for women's rights. Her mother had raised her in a theosophical tradition, along with Anglicanism, of course. It was a really interesting mix. And she read poems and believed in reincarnation. She thought I was the reincarnation of her cousin Curtis, her bachelor cousin Curtis, her extremely artistic cousin Curtis. And I realized at a very early age, she knew who I was. And whenever I would tell her, she'd be looking at my hand and she'd say, so tell me again what you want to do. And I said, I'm going to be a lawyer like Daddy. And she would close my hand and pat it and change the subject. Because she didn't want to be trouble when she was visiting the family. And that actually, to finish that granny story, I adored her. And she was, a very vivid person. She wore these big feathered hats. And I'd had this sort of semi-mystical presence in my life who was also very forgiving and tolerant, and I think she must have had a lot of gay friends back in the old days. So I used her. I think of her as my higher self, where the good influence came from, and I used her as much as I could.
I know we're all looking back, but I wondered what's in store for us? What's next? Are you going to write some more?
I've been confessing this for the last 5 days, so I guess I can't stop now, but I'd really like to do a one-man show. I saw Quentin Crisp when I was young and impressionable and watched him hold an audience for an hour just telling stories and holding forth on life, and I think I'd like to try that for a bit. Chris and I joke about getting an Airstream trailer and taking the Labradoodle and driving around the Southwest and doing, you know, Uncle Armistead's dog and pony show. But I think it's what I need right now. I really don't want to sit down for another year and a half or two and write any kind of new novel, although I may, after my first dreadful opening night, I may run back to the computer really fast, but yeah, that's sort of on my mind right now.
I'm sure there are lots of people here who still like to ask questions, but precisely because I'm sure also that Armistead would go on answering them so generously, I'm going to bring proceedings to a close.
May I thank you, John? This has been really a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me.
I've really enjoyed it.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.